Track 15. Zeppelins on the lawns at Overstrand. Chris Armstrong writes about the sad story of Sir Edgar Speyer and his family.
Occasionally one hears that Winston Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, mobilised the fleet at the start of the First World War by calling London from a telephone at what is now the Sea Marge Hotel at Overstrand. Certainly, Churchill was quite a frequent visitor to Overstrand and was very familiar with the property and the family who owned it. But I doubt the story of the phone call is anything more than a myth. The myth tends to obscure the far more interesting and evidentially robust story of the family who occupied the house at the time. Sea Marge was built for a banker called Sir Edgar Speyer as a summer retreat. He was prone to refer to it as a cottage. Some cottage. But then Speyer didn't go in for things in small measure. His main Mayfair residence on Grosvenor Street comprised of two houses which he melded into one, retaining both original staircases in case he should want to split the houses again later. The result was an enormous property, which included a very large music room, in which he hosted performances by some of the most distinguished musicians and composers of the day. Amongst his friends and guests were Elgar, Debussy and Grieg. Edgar Speyer was born in New York to German parents and educated in Germany. The Speyer family had for generations been bankers, primarily in Frankfurt, but also in New York and London, and had accumulated great wealth. In 1886, Edgar, at the age of 24, was posted to London to manage the British operation. He was very successful, not just in banking, but also in establishing himself as a major figure in the artistic life of late Victorian and Edwardian London. His love of music was the driver for much of his early philanthropic activity. He's recognised as the man who saved the proms from extinction when Sir Henry Wood's original backer became bankrupt. His musical interests were enhanced still further when he met Leonora von Stosch, a leading violinist. The daughter of a German aristocrat who, dropping this title, had gone to live in the United States, and an American mother, she was born in Washington. She was American and she was divorced from her first husband. She and Edgar were married in 1902 and appear to have been happy. They had three daughters. But for all his contribution to the artistic and musical life of London, his commercial skills contributed to what is his most lasting memorial, the modern underground system. The Metropolitan Line had been the world's first underground railway, opening in 1863. Powered by steam, it was barely underground, constructed by digging a deep trench along existing roads, lining the sides with brick and covering the trench with roofing before relaying the road above it. The result was a very shallow tunnel. My great-great-grandfather, a director of the company, was able, when the roof collapsed during a pre-launch trial, to escape by shinning up a short ladder to the road above. The Metropolitan Railway was followed over the next decades by a hodgepodge of others, the last being the Central Line, opened in 1903. By then there had been great progress, not just in tunnelling, but also in the development of electric power to drive the trains. The District Line, bought by an American bond salesman, Charles Yerkes, with a somewhat murky reputation, having served time for larceny, was powered by electricity. Yerkes set up a new company backed by Speyer and Speyer's bank called the Underground Electric Railways of London, the UERL. Speyer's role was to raise the capital to fund the electrification of the Metropolitan and to build new routes. Before much could be done, Yerkes died, and Edgar took over as chairman. There were huge financial problems. Speyer's bank had to dig very deep to meet payments to bondholders. But the financial implications didn't put Edgar Speyer off. After an unsuccessful attempt to get the government to finance the business, he set out to complete the task himself. Tunnels were excavated at an average depth of 80 feet, using electrically powered excavators. A new generating station was built to provide the power to run the trains. By 1910, the Circle, Metropolitan, District, Piccadilly, Bakerloo and Northern lines were all running efficiently on electricity. Other lines were acquired and modernised, and he was dubbed the King of the Underground in the popular press. The one thing he couldn't deliver was profit, but he left a legacy which has been useful to every generation since. All this activity, both in the arts and in transport, added to many more philanthropic gestures, made Speyer a major figure in Edwardian England. He'd already become a British citizen in 1892. He was created a baronet in 1906 and a member of the Privy Council in 1909. He was a close friend of Asquith, who was Prime Minister from 1908, and was friendly with Churchill. Things must have looked pretty rosy. Widely respected in both government and artistic circles, he had also been largely responsible for funding Captain Scott's expedition to the Antarctica. And in fact, Scott left a letter of appreciation written while waiting for his death on the ice. Edgar had achieved a very elevated position in society as a result of his generosity and his abilities. There seemed to be a great future for him in his adopted land. But he was about to fall from grace, becoming the victim of an explosive cocktail of malice, prejudice and extreme nationalism, perhaps shaken with a dash of anti-Semitism. The proximate cause was the start of the First World War, but it seems reasonable to infer from the nature of some of the attacks on him that there were elements of personal vindictiveness too. All those with German family connections were suspect, but there was a particular distrust of those who had been successful. Lord Charles Beresford, no stranger to scandal himself, declared at an anti-German rally that the most dangerous enemies in our midst are the rich, independent, naturalised Germans in high social positions, still Germans at heart. The press latched on to this sentiment with glee. Rumours abounded that Edgar had been signalling to German submarines by torch from the clifftop gardens of Sea Marge or by wireless from within the house. It was even believed by the credulous that he planned to use the tennis courts at Sea Marge as a base for zeppelins. It must have seemed extraordinary to him. Here he was, a major benefactor to the country of his adoption, on close terms with the country's leaders, awarded a baronetcy and membership of the Privy Council in recognition of his services, and previously the recipient of a positive press for his charitable acts. But suddenly, he was the object of hatred. And not just him. Lady Speyer was ostracised and barred from the several charities that she had served. He took a conciliatory course, asking to be removed from the Privy Council and to have his baronetcy rescinded, writing to his friend Asquith, who replied to the effect that the King would not countenance such an action. Asquith also confirmed his absolute faith in the integrity of Sir Edgar and his loyalty to the British Crown. Assaults in the press and on the floor of the Commons continued. While many of these were directed at Germans who had adopted British nationality in general, they did seem peculiarly personal in Sir Edgar's case. Why so? His friendship with the Prime Minister was regarded with suspicion. As a regular guest at Number 10, he was privy to information which might be of help to the enemy. Was he an active agent of the Kaiser? In the prevailing febrile situation, anything could happen. Anti-German sentiment had already resulted in the resignation of the first Sea Lord, Prince Louis of Battenberg, who at the behest of the King anglicised his name to Mountbatten. By 1915, Edgar Speyer had had enough. He took his wife and family to the United States. But the vengeful attackers were not finished with him yet, and in 1921 he returned to England for what was effectively a trial. It was held in camera, though he could and perhaps should have insisted on a public hearing. The result was that he was found guilty of disloyalty to the Crown and was stripped of the Privy Councillorship he had volunteered to surrender 6 years earlier. His naturalisation was also cancelled, as were those of his wife and his three daughters. His baronetcy could not be revoked, but given that he had no male heirs, that barely mattered. Because the trial had been held in private, the only information in the public domain was the judgment. None of his own evidence or explanations was released. There had been little evidence on which to convict him of anything significant. He'd communicated with family members in Germany. He had technically traded with the enemy to a very limited extent, but he had, as soon as the war was declared, severed his connection with the German branch of the family business. At most, he could be thought of as being naive. Whether he secretly sympathised with Germany, we don't know, but his draconian punishment 3 years after the war had ended seems a poor reward for so many years of generous and devoted service to his adopted country. The suggestion that he was a spy seems improbable. If he was, he wasn't just a sleeper, he was an extraordinarily deep one, and with even deeper pockets. It's difficult not to conclude that justice was not served by his treatment during and after the Great War. He returned to live in the United States, but died in 1932 in Germany, following supposedly minor surgery. There is a rather unexpected sequel. Depriving his young children of their British citizenship on thin evidence that their father may have had pro-German sympathies seems vindictive in the extreme, but it is rather reassuring to know that all three returned to England, two of them to settle here permanently.